Section 5. Pantheism. A. What pantheism is. If the etymology of the word pantheism be allowed to determine its meaning, the answer to the question, what is pantheism, is easy. The universe is God, and God is the universe. To pantheos esti. This is not only the signification of the word and the popular idea usually attached to it, but it is the formal definition often given of the term. Thus Wegscheider says, pantheismus est eis sententia, qua mundum non secretum enumine actus paradum, sed ad ipsum de essentium pertinere quidam opinari sunt. 254 This, however, is pronounced by the advocates of the doctrine to be a gross misrepresentation. The idea that the universe, as the aggregate of individual things, is God, is, they say, a form of thought, which the earliest philosophy of the East had surmounted. It might as well be said that the contents of a man's consciousness, at any one time, were the man himself. Or that the waves of the ocean were the ocean itself. It is because so many pantheists take the word in the sense above indicated, that they deny that they are pantheists, and affirm their belief in the being of God. As the system which is properly designated pantheism, does exclude the popular view of the subject, derived from the etymology of the word. And as it has been held in very different forms, it is not easy to give a concise and satisfactory answer to the question, what is pantheism? The three principal forms in which the doctrine has been presented are, 1. That which ascribes to the infinite and universal being, the attributes to a certain extent at least of both mind and matter, namely, thought and extension. 2. That which ascribes to it only the attributes of matter, materialistic pantheism. 3. That which ascribes to it only the attributes of spirit, idealistic pantheism. General principles of the system. For the purpose of theological instruction, it is sufficient to state what these several systems unite in denying, and what they substantially agree in affirming. 1. They deny all dualism in the universe. The essential distinction between matter and mind, between soul and body, between God and the world, between the infinite and the finite is repudiated. There is but one substance, but one real being. Hence the doctrine is called monism, or the all-one doctrine. The idea, says Cousin, 255 of the finite, of the infinite, and of their necessary connection as cause and effect, meet in every act of intelligence, nor is it possible to separate them from each other. Though distinct, they are bound together, and constitute at once a triplicity and unity. The first term, the infinite, though absolute, exists not absolutely in itself, but is an absolute cause which must pass into action, and manifest itself in the second, the finite. The finite cannot exist without the infinite, and the infinite can only be realized by developing itself in the finite. All philosophy is founded, he says, on the ideas of unity and multiplicity, of substance and phenomena. Behold, he says, all the propositions which we had enumerated reduced to a single one, as vast as reason and the possible, to the opposition of unity and plurality, of substance and phenomena, of being and appearance, of identity and difference. 256 All men, he says, believe, as it were, in a combination of phenomena which would cease to be at the moment in which the eternal substance should cease to sustain them. They believe, as it were, in the visible manifestation of a concealed principle which speaks to them under this cover, and which they adore in nature and in consciousness. 257 As God is made known only in so far as He is absolute cause, on this account, in my opinion, He cannot but produce, so that the creation ceases to be unintelligible, and God is no more without a world than a world without God. 258 It is one of the most familiar aphorisms of the German philosophers, Unwelt kein Gott. Und ohne Gott kein Welt, wenn in es weide Jesus, understands by pantheism, materialism, or the denial of a living God. This would exclude all the forms of the doctrines held by idealistic pantheists in all ages. Dr. Calderwood pronounces Sir William Hamilton's doctrine of creation pantheistic, because it denies that the sum of existence can either be increased or diminished. Sir William Hamilton teaches that when we say God created the world out of nothing, we can only mean that He evolves existence out of Himself. Although all the forms of pantheism are monistic, except hylozoism, which is properly dualistic, yet the mere doctrine of the unity of substance does not constitute pantheism. However objectionable the doctrine may be that everything that exists, even unorganized matter, is of the substance of God, it has been held by many Christian theists. This does not necessarily involve the denial of the essential distinction between matter and mind. 2. However they differ as to the nature of the infinite is such, whether it be matter or spirit, or that of which both thought and extension potentially can be predicated, or whether it be thought itself, or force, or cause, or nothing, that is that of which nothing can be affirmed or denied, a simple unknown quantity. They all agree that it has no existence either before or out of the world. The world is, therefore, not only consubstantial, but co-eternal with God. 3. This of course precludes the idea of creation, except as an eternal and necessary process. 4. They deny that the infinite and absolute being in itself has either intelligence, consciousness, or will. The infinite comes into existence in the finite. The whole life, consciousness, intelligence, and knowledge, at any time, of the former, is the life, consciousness, intelligence, and knowledge of the latter, that is of the world. Ars mens, says Spinoza, simul Dei urnam et infinitum intellectum constituit. 259 God alone is, and out of him is nothing. 260 Seine existence als Wesen ist unser Denken von ihm. Aber seine real existence ist die Natur. Zu welcher das Einzel Denken als Moment GHT. 261. 5. Pantheism denies the personality of God. Personality as well as consciousness implies a distinction between the self and the not-self. And such distinction is a limitation inconsistent with the nature of the infinite. God, therefore, is not a person who can say I, and who can be addressed as thou. As he comes into existence, intelligence, and consciousness only in the world, he is a person only so far as he comprehends all personalities, and the consciousness of the sum of finite creatures constitutes the consciousness of God. The true doctrine of Hegel on the subject, says Michelet, 262, is not that God is a person as distinguished from other persons. Neither is he simply the universal or absolute substance. He is the movement of the absolute ever making itself subjective. And in the subjective first comes to objectivity or to true existence. God, he adds, according to Hegel, is the only true personal being. As God is eternal personality, so he eternally produces his other self, namely, nature, in order to come to self-consciousness. It follows of necessity from the doctrine that God is the substance of which the universe is the phenomena. That God has no existence but in the world. That the aggregate consciousness and life of the finite is, for the time being, the whole consciousness and life of the infinite. That the infinite cannot be a person distinct from the world, to whom we can say, thou. On this point Cousin says, take away my faculties, and the consciousness that attests them to me, and I am not for myself. It is the same with God. Take away nature, and the soul, and every sign of God disappears. 263 What the soul would be without faculties and without consciousness, that is God without the universe. An unconscious God, without life, of whom nothing can be predicated but simple being, is not only not a person, but is, for us, nothing. 6. Man is not an individual subsistence. He is but a moment in the life of God. A wave on the surface of the sea. A leaf which falls and is renewed year after year. 7. When the body, which makes the distinction of persons among men, perishes, personality ceases with it. There is no conscious existence for man after death. Schleiermacher, in his Discourses, says, the piety in which he was nurtured in his youth, remained with me when the God and immortality of my childhood disappeared from my doubting sight. 264 On this avowal, Mr. Hunt, curate of St. Ives, Hunts, comments the God and immortality of his childhood disappeared. The personal God whom the Moravians worshipped was exchanged for the impersonal divinity of philosophy. Nor did this theology seem impious. No, it was the very essence of true religion. There is good reason to believe that with regard to the personal existence of the soul after death, Schleiermacher sacrificed his philosophy, as he certainly did in other points, to his religion. This, however, only the more clearly shows how inconsistent the pantheistic view of the nature of God is with the doctrine of conscious existence after death. The absorption of the soul in God, of the finite into the infinite, is the highest destiny that pantheism can acknowledge for man. 8. As man is only a mode of God's existence, his acts are the acts of God, and as the acts of God are necessary, it follows that there can be no freedom of the will in man. Spinoza says, 265 hinc sequitur mentem humanam partem s infinity intellectus Dei ac proincum dicimus, mentem humanam hoc velilit persevere, nihil alia dicimus, quam quantius, non quitinus infinitus est, sed quitinus per naturam human mentis explicator, sed quitinus human mentis essentiam constitute, hanc velilum habet ideem. In ment nulla est absoluta sed libera voluntas. Mens certus et determinatus modus cogitandi est adiox suarum actionem non potest es causa libera. 266 Iodem hoc modo demonstrator, in ment nullum dare facultatem absolutum intelligendi, capendi, amendi, etc. 267. Cousin says, we are thus arrived then in the analysis of the me, by the way of psychology still, at a new aspect of ontology, at a substantial activity, interior and superior to all phenomenal activity, which produces all the phenomena of activity, survives them all, and renews them all, immortal and inexhaustible, in the destruction of its temporary manifestations. 268 Thus our activity is only a temporary manifestation of the activity of God. All our acts are His acts. 269 Mr. Hunt, analyzing Spinoza's system, and using mainly his language on this point, says, Spinoza ascribed to God a kind of freedom, a free necessity. But to created existences even this kind of freedom is denied. There is nothing contingent in the nature of beings. All things, on the contrary, are determined by the necessity of the divine nature, to exist and to act, after a certain fashion. Nature produced is determined by nature producing. It does not act, it is acted upon. The soul of man is a spiritual automaton. There can be nothing arbitrary in the necessary developments of the divine essence. 270. As pantheism makes creation an eternal, necessary, and continuous evolution of the infinite being, all liberty of second causes is of necessity excluded. A distinction may be made between the necessity by which a stone falls to the ground, and the necessity by which a mind thinks. But the necessity is as absolute in the one case as in the other. Liberty in man is rational self-determination, that is, spontaneity determined by reason. But reason in man is impersonal, according to pantheism. It is God as explicated in us. All the acts of the human mind are the acts of God as determined by the necessity of his nature. The same doctrine of fatalism is involved in the idea that history is merely the self-evolution of God. One idea, or phase of the infinite being, is exhibited by one age or nation, and a different one by another. But the whole is as much a necessary process of evolution as the growth of a plant. Sir William Hamilton, therefore, says that Cousin destroys liberty by divorcing it from intelligence, and that his doctrine is inconsistent not only with theism but with morality, which cannot be founded on a liberty which at best only escapes necessity by taking refuge with chance. 271 And Moral, a eulogist of Cousin, says, that according to Cousin God is the ocean, we are but the waves. The ocean may be one individuality, and each wave another. But still they are essentially one and the same. We see not how Cousin's theism can possibly be consistent with any idea of moral evil. Neither do we see how, starting from such a dogma, he can ever vindicate and uphold his own theory of human liberty. On such theistic principles, all sin must be simply defect, and all defect must be absolutely fortuitous. 272. 9. Pantheism, in making man a mode of God's existence, and in denying all freedom of the will, and in teaching that all phenomenal activity is a transient manifestation of the activity of God, precludes the possibility of sin. This does not mean that there is in man no sentiment of approbation or disapprobation, no subjective difference between right and wrong. This would be as absurd as to say that there is no difference between pleasure and pain. But if God be at once God, nature, and humanity, if reason in us be God's reason, His intelligence our intelligence, His activity our activity, if God be the substance of which the world is the phenomena, if we are only moments in the life of God, then there can be nothing in us which is not in God. Evil is only limitation, or undeveloped good. One tree is larger and finer than another. One mind is more vigorous than another. One mode of action more pleasurable than another. But all alike are modes of God's activity. Water is water, whether in the puddle or in the ocean. And God is God, in Nero or St. John. Hegel says that sin is something unspeakably higher than the law-abiding motion of the planets, or the innocence of plants. That is, it is a higher manifestation of the life of God. Spinoza teaches that sin is nothing positive. It exists for us but not for God. The same things which appear hateful in men are regarded with admiration in animals. It follows then that sin, which only expresses an imperfection, cannot consist in anything which expresses a reality. We speak improperly, applying human language to what is above human language, when we say that we sin against God, or that men offend God. 273. It is the necessary consequence of the doctrine that God is the universal being, that the more of being the more of God, and therefore the more of good. And consequently the less of being, the less of good. All limitation, therefore, is evil. And evil is simply limitation of being. Spinoza 274 says, Quo magis anusquis suum est conserver conater et potest, ego magis virtud per idus est. Contra quotinus anusquis suum est conserver negligit, etinus est imprudens. In the demonstration of this proposition, he says, Virtus est ipsi humana potentia, 275 making power and goodness identical. Professor Bohr of Tiengen, 276 says evil is what is finite. For the finite is negative. The negation of the infinite. It is only, as just said, another form of this doctrine that power, or strength, is in man the only good. This does not mean the strength to submit to injury. The strength of self-sacrifice. The strength to be humble and to resist evil passion, but the power to carry out our own purposes in opposition to the will, interests, or happiness of others. That is, that might is right. The victor is always right, the vanquished is always wrong. This is only one manifestation of God, suppressing or superseding a less perfect manifestation. Spinoza's doctrine is, to the pursuit of what is agreeable, and the hatred of the contrary, man is compelled by his nature, for everyone desires or rejects by necessity, according to the laws of his nature, that which he judges good or bad. To follow this impulse is not only a necessity but it is the right and the duty of every man, and everyone should be reckoned an enemy who wishes to hinder another in the gratification of the impulses of his nature. The measure of everyone's right is his power. The best right is that of the strongest. And as the wise man has an absolute right to do all which reason dictates, or the right of living according to the laws of reason, so also the ignorant and foolish man has a right to live according to the laws of appetite. 277 A more immoral and demoralizing principle was never expressed in human language. To say that it is the duty of every man to seek his own gratification, to satisfy the impulses of his nature. That he is an enemy who attempts to hinder that gratification. That the only limit to such gratification is our power. That men have the right, if so inclined, to live according to the laws of appetite, is to say that there is no such thing as moral obligation. No such thing as right or wrong. Cousin repeats ad nauseam the doctrine that might is right. That the strongest is always the best. We usually see in success, he says, only a triumph of force. I hope I have shown that, inasmuch as there always must be a vanquished party, and inasmuch as the vanquished party is always that which ought to be vanquished, to accuse the vanquisher and to take part against victory, is to take part against humanity, and to complain of the progress of civilization. It is necessary to go further. It is necessary to prove that the vanquished party deserves to be vanquished. that the vanquishing party not only serves the cause of civilization, but that it is better and more moral than the vanquished party. Virtue and prosperity, misfortune and vice, are a necessary harmony. Feebleness is a vice, and, therefore, it is always punished and beaten. It is time, he says, that philosophy of history put beneath its feet the declamations of philanthropy. 278 It must, of course, be true, if God is the life of the world, all power His power, every act His act, not only that there can be no sin, but that the most powerful are always morally, if that word has any meaning, the best. And that might is right. This is the theory on which hero worship is founded, not only among the heathen, but among Christians, so-called, of our day. 10. Pantheism is self-deification. If God comes to existence only in the world, and if everything that is a manifestation of God, it follows that so far as this earth is concerned, and so far as pantheists allow or acknowledge the soul of man as the highest form of the existence of God, as the souls of men differ very much one from another, one being much superior to others, the greater the man the more divine he is, that is, the more does he represent God. The more of the divine essence does he reveal. The highest step of development is reached only by those who come to the consciousness of their identity with God. This is the precise doctrine of the Hindus, who teach that when a man is able to say, "I am Brahm," the moment of his absorption into the infinite being has arrived. This is the ground on which the pantheistic philosophers rest their claim of preeminence, and the ground on which they conceive the preeminence of Christ. He, more than any other man, saw into the depths of his own nature. He was able to say as no other man could say, "I and the Father are one." But the difference between Christ and other men is only one of degree. The human race is the incarnation of God, which is a process from eternity to eternity. Mankind, says Strauss, is the God-man. The key of a true Christology is that the predicates which the Church gives to Christ, as an individual, belong to an idea, a generic whole. 279. 11. There is only one step further, and that is, the deification of evil. That step pantheists do not hesitate to take. So far as evil exists, it is as truly a manifestation of God as good. The wicked are only one form of the self-manifestation of God. Sin is only one form of the activity of God. This dreadful doctrine is explicitly avowed. Rosenkrantz says, 280 die dread consequence endlich ist die. Das Gott der Sonne auch als identisch gesetzt ist mit dem Subjekt, in welchem die Religie vorstellen den Ursprung des Bien anschaut, mit dem Satan, Phosphoros, Lucifer. Dies Verschmelzung BGR des Sick Darin, das der Sonne in Rob Gott das Moment der Unterscheidung ist, in dem Unterschied aber die Umlichkeit der Entgegensetzung und Entzweigung Engelit ist. Der Sonne ist der Selbstbewusst Gott. Such a sentence as the foregoing has never been written in English, and, we trust, never will be. The conclusion it avows, however, is unavoidable. If God be everything, and if there be a Satan, God must be Satan. Rosenkrantz says that the mind is horrified at such language, only because it does not recognize the intimate connection between good and evil. That evil is in good, and good in evil. Without evil there can be no good. It may be because of this deification of evil that a recent German writer, 281, said that this system should be called pandeevilism instead of pantheism. He, if we mistake not, is the author of the article in Hengstenberg's Kirchenzeitung, 282 inches, which it is said. This is the true positive blasphemy of God, this veiled blasphemy, this diabolism of a deceitful angel of light, the speaking of reckless words, with which the man of sin sets himself in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. The atheist cannot blaspheme within such power as this. His blasphemy is merely negative. He merely says there is no God. It is only out of pantheism that a blasphemy can proceed, so wild, of such inspired mockery, so devoutly godless, so desperate in its love of the world, a blasphemy so seductive, and so offensive that it may well call for the destruction of the world. Pantheism, however, becomes all things to all men. To the pure, it gives scope for a sentimental religious feeling which sees God in everything and everything in God. To the proud, it is the source of intolerable arrogance and self-conceit. To the sensual, it gives authority for every form of indulgence. The body being a mode of God's extension, according to Spinoza's theory, as the mind is a mode of the divine intelligence, the body has its divine rights as well as the soul. Even some of the most reputable of the pantheistic school do not hesitate to say in reference to the trammels of morality, it is well that the rights of our sensual nature should, from time to time, be boldly asserted. 283 This system, therefore, as even the moderate Tholuck says, comes to the same result with the materialism of French encyclopedists, who mourn over mankind for having sacrificed the real pleasures of time for the imaginary pleasures of eternity, and the protracted enjoyments of life, for the momentary happiness of a peaceful death. Pantheism, therefore, merges everything into God. The universe is the existence form of God. That is, the universe is His existence. All reason is His reason. All activity is His activity. The consciousness of creatures is all the consciousness God has of Himself. Good and evil, pain and pleasure, are phenomena of God. Modes in which God reveals Himself, the way in which He passes from being into existence. He is not, therefore, a person whom we can worship and in whom we can trust. He is only the substance of which the universe and all that it contains are the ever-changing manifestation. Pantheism admits of no freedom, no responsibility, no conscious life after death. Cousin sums up the doctrine in this comprehensive paragraph: the God of consciousness is not an abstract God, a solitary monarch exiled beyond the limits of creation, upon the desert throne of a silent eternity, and of an absolute existence which resembles even the negation of existence. He is a God at once true and real, at once substance and always cause, being substance only in so far as He is cause, and cause only so far as He is substance, that is to say, being absolute cause, one and many, eternity and time, space and number, essence and life, indivisibility and totality, principle, end, and center, at the summit of being and at its lowest degree, infinite and finite together, triple, in a word, that is to say, at the same time God, nature, and humanity. In fact, if God be not everything, He is nothing. 284. History of Pantheism. Pantheism has proved itself to be the most persistent as well as the most widespread form of human thought relative to the origin and nature of the universe, and its relation to the infinite being, whose existence in some form seems to be a universal and necessary assumption. Pantheistic ideas underlie almost all the forms of religion which have existed in the world. Polytheism, which has been almost universal, has its origin in nature worship. And nature worship rests on the assumption that nature is God, or the manifestation, or existence form of the infinite unknown. Of course, it is only the briefest outline of the different forms of this portentous system of error that can be given in these pages. Be Brahminical Pantheism. Ethnographically, the Hindus belong to the same race as the Greeks, Romans, and other great European nations. In prehistoric periods, one division of the great Aryan family spread itself westward over the territory which now constitutes Europe. Another division extended south and east and entered India, displacing almost entirely the original inhabitants of that large, diversified, and fertile region. Long before Greece or Rome became cultivated communities, and when Europe was the home only of uncivilized barbarians, India was covered with rich and populous cities. The arts had reached the highest state of development. A literature and language which, in the judgment of scholars, rival those of Greece and Rome, had been produced, and systems of philosophy as profound, as subtle, and as diversified as the human mind ever elaborated, were already taught in her schools. The Hindus number nearly 200 millions of souls. They are now, in the essential principles of their philosophy, their religion, and their social organization, what they were 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. Never in the history of the world has a form of religious philosophy been so extensively embraced, so persistently adhered to, or so effective in molding the character and determining the destiny of a people. Few questions of the kind, therefore, are of deeper interest than what the true character of the Hindu religion actually is. The decision of that question is not free from difficulty. And it has, therefore, received very different answers. The difficulty in this case arises from various sources. 1. The religious books of the Hindus are not only written in Sanskrit, a language unintelligible, except to a small class of learned men, but they are exceedingly voluminous. The Vedas, the most ancient and authoritative, fill 14 volumes folio. The Institutes of Manu, the Puranas, and the sacred poems, Ramayana and Mahabharata, are equally extensive. The former of these poems consists of 100,000 verses, and the latter of 400,000, while the Ida has only 12,000, and the Iliad 24,000. Sir William Jones said that the student of the Hindu literature and religion found himself in time presence of infinity. 2. It is not only, however, the voluminousness of the authoritative sacred books, but the character of their contents, which creates the difficulty of getting a clear idea of the system which they teach. The Vedas consist mainly of hymns of various ages, interspersed with brief obscure, philosophical or theological explanations and comments. The Puranas are filled with extravagant legends, which are to be interpreted historically, and which mythically, it is difficult to decide. 3. The spirit of exaggeration is so characteristic of the Hindu mind that statements meant to be understood literally shock the mind by their extravagance. Thus their books make the earth a circular plane 170 millions of miles in diameter. They speak of mountains 60 miles high, and of periods of 4,000 millions of years. The religion of the Hindus is not originally monotheistic. It is a common opinion that the Hindu religion was originally and for centuries monotheistic. That out of monotheism gradually rose the present complicated and monstrous polytheism, and that contemporaneously among the philosophical class were developed the different forms of pantheism. But this is contrary to well-established facts, and is altogether unsatisfactory as a solution of the great problem of Hindu life. It is indeed true, as we know from the Bible, that monotheism was the earliest form of religion among men. And it is also true in all probability that the Vedas, which are collections of ancient hymns, contain some which belong to the monotheistic period. Most of those, however, which appear to assume the existence of one God, are to be understood in a pantheistic and not in a theistic sense. These recognize one divine being, but that one includes all the other forms of being. The history of religion shows that when monotheism failed among men because they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, it was replaced by the worship of nature. This nature worship assumed two forms. The different elements, as fire, air, and water, were personified, endowed with personal attributes and divine powers, giving rise to polytheism. Or nature as a whole was the object of worship, giving rise to pantheism. It is evident that among the highly intellectual Aryans who settled in India, between 1 and 2,000 years before Christ, the pantheistic view had obtained the ascendancy, not as a philosophical theory merely, but as a religious doctrine. It became, and has continued until this day, the foundation of the religious, civil, and social life of the Hindu. It is this which gives it its paramount importance. It stands alone in history. In no other case, among no other people, has pantheism become the controlling form of religious belief among the people, so as to determine their institutions and to mold their character. The Hindus, therefore, have an interest for Christians and for the religious philosopher which attaches to no other heathen nation. They show, and were doubtless intended to show, what are the legitimate effects of pantheism. That doctrine has had dominant control for millenniums over highly cultivated and intelligent people, and in their character and state we see its proper fruits. It was pantheistic. That the religion of the Hindus is fundamentally pantheistic, is evident. 1. From what their sacred writings teach of the Supreme Being. It is designated by a word in the neuter gender, Brahm. It is never addressed as a person. It is never worshipped. It has no attributes but such as may be predicated of space. It is said to be eternal, infinite, immutable. It is said to have continued for untold ages in the state of unintelligent, unconscious being. It comes to existence, to consciousness, and life, in the world, It unfolds itself through countless ages in all the forms of finite existence. And then by a like gradual process all things are resolved into unconscious being. The illustrations of the origin of the world commonly employed are sparks issuing from a burning mass. Or, better, vapor rising from the ocean, condensing and falling back to the source whence it came. Being as such, or the infinite, is, therefore, viewed in three aspects as coming to existence, as developing itself in the world, as receiving everything back into the abyss of simple being. These different aspects are expressed by the words, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, to which our terms, creator, preserver, and destroyer, answer very imperfectly. We have here the constantly recurring pantheistic formula, thesis, analysis, synthesis. Being. Development, restoration. The infinite, the finite, and their identity. The principal difference between the Brahminical system and the theories of the later pantheists, is that the latter make the universe co-eternal with God. The infinite from eternity to eternity develops itself in the finite. Whereas, according to the former, there was an inconceivably long period of repose antecedent to the process of development, and that process after millions of ages, is to be followed by a like period of unconsciousness and rest. Relation of infinite being to the world. 2. The relation of God to the world, or rather of the infinite to the finite, is the same in the Brahminical, as in other pantheistic systems. That relation has been already intimated. It is that of identity. The world is the existence form of God. God is everything, good and evil. And everything is God. But in very different degrees. There is more of being that is, of God in a plant than in unorganized matter. More in an animal than in the plant, more in man than in either. More in one man, or race of men, than in another. Relation of pantheism to polytheism. 3. The vast polytheistic system of the Hindus is founded on pantheism and is its logical consequence. In the first place, as just remarked, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, commonly called the Hindu Trinity, are not persons, but personifications, or different aspects under which infinite being is to be regarded. In the second place, as the infinite being manifests itself in different degrees in different persons and things, anything extraordinary in nature, any remarkable man, is regarded as a special manifestation or embodiment of God. Hence the frequent avatars or incarnations of the Hindu mythology. In this way the gods may be, and have been indefinitely multiplied. Any person or thing, or quality, may be defined as a manifestation of infinite being. In the third place, this accounts for the facts that the Hindu gods are regarded as destitute of moral excellence, and that even evil, as under the name of Kali, the goddess of cruelty and patroness of murderers, may be the special object of reverence. In the fourth place, no god, not even Brahma or Vishnu, is, according to the Hindu system, immortal. All gods and goddesses are at length to be merged in the abyss of infinite, unconscious being. Effect of pantheism on religion. 4. Pantheism, as it makes being, God, as it recognizes no attribute but power in the objects of worship, divorces morality from religion. It is not in the power of any system, however sincerely embraced, to reverse the laws of our nature. And, therefore, in despite of the prevalence of a doctrine which denies the possibility of either sin or virtue, and makes everything dependent on fate, or the power of arbitrary being, the people in various ways recognize the obligation of the moral law and the excellence of virtue. But this has nothing to do with their religion. The great object of all religious observances was final absorption in God. Their proximate object was to propitiate some power by which the worshipper would be raised one or more steps toward the state in which that absorption is possible. On this point Professor Wilson says 285 entire dependence upon Krishna, or any other favorite deity, not only obviates the necessity of virtue, but it sanctifies vice. Conduct is wholly immaterial. It matters not how atrocious a sinner a man may be, if he paints his face, his breast, his arms with certain sectarial marks. Or, which is better, if he brands his skin permanently with them with a hot iron stamp. If he is constantly chanting hymns in honor of Vishnu, or, what is equally efficacious, If he spends hours in the simple reiteration of his name or names. If he die with the word Hari, or Ore, or Krishna on his lips, and the thought of him in his mind, he may have lived a monster of iniquity, he is certain of heaven. Certain of heaven is a Christian form of expression and conveys an idea foreign to the Hindu mind. What such a worshipper hopes and expects is that when next born into the world it may be in a higher state and so much the nearer his final absorption. As Professor Wilson is not only moderate, but almost apologetic in the account which he gives of the religion of the Hindus, the above-quoted statement cannot be suspected of unfairness or exaggeration. Character of the Hindu worship. The two leading characteristics of the Hindu worship are cruelty and indecency. And these are sufficiently accounted for by the pantheism which underlies the whole system. Pantheism denies the distinction between virtue and vice. It recognizes no attribute but power. It deifies evil. It sanctifies vice. Passion, sensual or malignant, is as much a mode of divine manifestation as the most heroic virtue. Indeed, there is no room for the idea of moral excellence. Hence the prescriptions of religion have reference almost exclusively to rites and ceremonies. The Brahmin when he rises must bathe in a certain way, stand in a certain posture, extend his fingers in a prescribed manner. He must salute the rising sun, resting on one foot. He must repeat certain words. When he eats, the dish must be placed according to rule. He must make prescribed motions with his hands, and so on through the whole day. Every act is prescribed, everything is religious. Everything either defiles or purifies, ceremonially, but of moral defilement or purity there seems to be in their religion no recognition. The anthropology of the Hindus. 5. The anthropology of the Hindus proves the pantheistic character of their whole system. Man is only a part of God, a mode of his existence. He is compared to a portion of sea water enclosed in a bottle and thrown into the ocean. The water in the bottle is the same in nature as that without. As soon as the bottle is broken, the water within it is lost in the surrounding ocean. Another illustration of the destiny of the soul is that of a lump of salt thrown into the ocean, which immediately disappears. Its individuality is lost. This absorption of the soul is the highest beatification which pantheism offers to its votaries, but this, in the case of the vast majority of men, can be attained only after a long process of transmigrations extending, it may be, through millions of years. If a man be faithful and punctilious in his religious observances, he comes into the world after death in a higher state. Thus, a Sudra may become a Brahmin. But if unfaithful, he will be born in a lower form, it may be, in that of a reptile. It is thus, by these alternations, that the wish for absorption in Brahm is ultimately attained. With regard to the sacred, or Brahminical caste, the process may be shorter. A Brahmin's life is divided, according to the Institutes of Menu, into four periods: childhood, student life, life as householder, and finally, the ascetic period. As soon as a Brahmin feels the approach of old age, he is directed to retire from the world, to live as a hermit, to subsist only on herbs, to deny himself all business and enjoyment, that by continued self-negation he may not only destroy the power of the body, and free himself from the influence of the things seen and temporal, but also lose the consciousness of his individuality, and be able at last to say, I am Brahm, and then be as lost in the infinite. The Hindu life is dominated by this doctrine of absorption in God after a long series of transmigrations, and by the division of the people into castes, which has in like manner its foundation in their theory of the relation of God to the world, or, of the infinite to the finite. The Brahminical, or sacred class, is a higher manifestation of God than the military class. The military, than the mercantile. The mercantile, than the servile. This is popularly expressed by saying that the first proceeds from the head, the second from the arms, the third from the body, and the fourth from the feet of Brahm. The member of one of the lower castes cannot pass into either of those above him, except that by merit ritual observances he may on his next birth into the world be advanced to a higher grade. And one of a higher caste, by neglect of the prescribed rule of living, may at his next birth find himself degraded into a lower caste, or even into a beast or a reptile. Hence the horror of losing caste, which places a man out of the line of advancement, and consigns him to an almost endless state of degradation. The effect of pantheism on the social life of the Hindus. 6. The whole religious and social life of the Hindu is controlled by the radical principle that all things are God, or modes of his existence, and all destined to return to him again. To a Hindu, his individual existence is a burden. It is a fall from God. Hence to get back, to be lost in the infinite, is the one great object of desire and effort. As this end is not to be attained by virtue, but by asceticism, by propitiation of the gods, their religion is simply a round of unmeaning ceremonies, or acts of self-denial, or self-torture. Their religion, therefore, tends to destroy all interest in the present life, which is regarded as a burden and degradation. It cuts the nerves of exertion. It presents no incentive to virtue. It promotes vice. It has all the effects of fatalism. The influence of the worship of deities without moral excellence, some of them monsters of iniquity. The belief that cruelty and obscenity are acceptable to these deities, and to cure their favor, cannot be otherwise than debasing. The world, therefore, sees in India the practical working of pantheism. The system has been an unrestricted operation, not as a philosophy, but as a practical religious belief, for thousands of years, and among a people belonging to the most favored of the various races of men, and the result is before our eyes. Greece and India, says Max Emler, 286, are, indeed, the two opposite poles in the historical development of the Aryan man. To the Greek, existence is full of life and reality. To the Hindu it is a dream, an illusion. The Hindu enters this world as a stranger. All his thoughts are directed to another world. He takes no part even where he is driven to act. And when he sacrifices his life, it is but to be delivered from it. No wonder that a nation like the Indian cared so little for history. No wonder that social and political virtues were little cultivated, and the ideas of the useful and the beautiful scarcely known to them. With all this, however, they had what the Greek was as little capable of imagining as they were of realizing the elements of Grecian life. They shut their eyes to this world of outward seeming and activity, to open them full on the world of thought and rest. Their life was a yearning after eternity. Their activity a struggle to return into that divine essence from which this life seemed to have severed them. Believing as they did in a divine and really existing eternal being to Antozan, they could not believe in the existence of this passing world. If the one existed, the other could only seem to exist. If they lived in the one, they could not live in the other. Their existence on earth was to them a problem, their eternal life a certainty. The highest object of their religion was to restore that bond by which their own self-man was linked to the eternal self-param-man. To recover that unity which had been clouded and obscured by the magical illusions of reality, by the so-called Maya of creation. In order to show how largely this idea of the Atman, as the divine spirit, entered into the early religious and philosophical speculations of the Indians, he quotes from one of the Vedas a dialogue in which, among other things, one of the speakers says, "Whosoever looks for this world, for the gods, for all beings, for this universe, elsewhere than in the divine spirit, should be abandoned by them all. This Brahmahood, this Kshatriya power, this world, these gods, these beings, this universe, all is the divine spirit." 287 The illustrations used by the speaker to show the relation of the phenomenal universe to God, are derived from the sounds issuing from a drum or a lute, smoke rising from a fire, vapor from the sea. He adds, "It is with us, when we enter into the divine spirit, as if a lump of salt was thrown into the sea, it becomes dissolved into the water from which it was produced, and is not to be taken out again. But wherever you take the water and taste it, it is salt. Thus is this great, endless, and boundless being but one mass of knowledge. As the water becomes salt, and the salt becomes water again, thus has the divine spirit appeared from out the elements and disappears again into them. When we have passed away, there is no longer any name." 288. There can therefore be no reasonable doubt that pantheism lies at the foundation of all the religion of India. There is, Indeed, the same difference between the present complex and corrupt polytheism of the Hindus and the teachings of the Vedas, that there is between the Roman Catholicism of our day and primitive Christianity. There is, however, this important distinction between the two cases. Popery is a perversion of Christianity by the introduction of incongruous elements derived from Jewish and heathen sources, whereas the religion of modern India is the legitimate and logical result of the principles of the earliest and purest of the Hindu sacred writings. The most accessible sources of information on the literature and religion of India are the writings of Sir William Jones, the writings of Colebrooke, the Journal of the Asiatic Society, the works of Prof. Wilson of Oxford, especially his essays and lectures on the religion of the Hindus, Max Emler's work just quoted, Dr. Duff's India and Indian Missions, and the Histories of India, by Macaulay, Elphinstone et al. 100 Grecian Pantheism. The remark of Max Emler, that Greece and India are the two opposite poles of the development of the Aryan man, is strikingly correct. The Greek believed in, and lived for the present and the visible. The Indian believed in, and lived for the invisible and the future. Nevertheless, there was a tendency in higher minds among the Greeks to adopt the same speculative views as to God and the universe, the infinite and the finite, as prevailed in India. With a Greek, however, it was a matter of speculation. With a Hindu, it was a practical religious belief. Speaking in general terms, the different forms of Grecian philosophy are characterized by the effort to reduce all the forms of existence to unity. To discover someone's substance, principle, or power, to which all modes of manifestation of being could be referred. Sometimes this one substance was assumed to be material. Sometimes spiritual. Sometimes the obvious incompatibility between the phenomena of mind and those of matter forced the admission of two eternal principles, the one active, the other passive. The one spiritual, the other material. The fundamental principle or idea, therefore, of the Grecian philosophy was pantheistic, either in its materialistic, spiritualistic, or halozoistic form.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.